Greetings and quiggle-matifilations, my ergophasic listeners, and welcome to this September 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this perennially censorific podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Okay, let's start out this lovely autumnal podcast with idiot pseudoscientists of the month. These moronic biohackers can hardly be called scientists as far as I'm concerned. This info is from an article by staff writer Daniel Oberhaus in Wired Magazine, and some of you may have read it, but I suspect not that many. The newest trend in biohacking is to insert computer components into your bodies. What components? Well, essentially microservers. Where? Well, pretty much anywhere where they'll fit. Biohacker Jeff Tebbets has a do-it-yourself operating room in his garage in California. He'll implant whatever electronic widget you want into your body, including the wireless key fob for your Tesla, if you are so inclined, or shall I say lazy, or paranoid enough to think you'll lose your car keys. Tibbetts' latest surgery is on Michael Laufer, the self-proclaimed anarcho-biohacker, who has had an implantable device called the peg leg inserted into, into his leg. Peg leg is a wireless router and hard drive, all rolled into one tiny little package. Laufer and his small group of biohackers created it using less than $50 of hardware. It's a little bigger than a pack of gum, and once it's implanted into your body, it turns you into a node of a local mesh network. Any Wi-Fi-enabled device can access the device's network, and the implant can also mesh with other peg legs to create what is effectively an Internet of Legs. I like that, by the way. That's a quote from the guy who wrote the paper, Oberhaus, an Internet of Legs. Peg leg doesn't connect to the Internet backbone that you're using to listen to this article, if you're listening to it online. Instead, it creates a local wireless network that anybody in the same room can access. The implant can store hundreds of gigabytes of data, stream movies, music, whatever, and act as a server for an anonymous chat room or forum and smuggle encrypted files across international borders. Pegleg was designed so that anyone who connects to the device's network can upload or download files to the hard drive anonymously. Of course, this sort of demented openness raises a whole bunch of legal questions about who's responsible for the data stored in somebody's body. Frankly, I think this is a bit on the insane side. Let's risk infection, gangrene, and potentially lose a limb so that we can carry around bootleg copies of the Justice League, or maybe Aquaman, in our bodies. It's like little kids who decide they want to play at being Johnny Mnemonic. If little kids played at being Johnny Mnemonic. For my audience not versed in classic science fiction, Johnny Mnemonic, the short story, not the less-than-stellar movie, was written by William Gibson. It tells the story of a courier who basically has a flash drive in his head and will carry your secret information across borders, and he doesn't even know what the information may be. Laufer says, quote, "Gibson had a big influence on me and the creation of Pegleg. To see technology progress in ways that Gibson predicted with a lot of fidelity is really cool. The only thing better is to be the ones bringing it into existence with this device." Unquote. Besides the physical issue and the question of whether a sane person needs one of these at all are the legal ramifications that I just mentioned a little bit ago, and the author does talk about this in the article. Given that anybody can upload files to the peg leg when it's turned on because it's an open network, and it's impossible to tell who uploaded a given file, it's easy to claim ignorance of its contents. But what happens if illegal material shows up on your peg leg, like classified government documents or child porn? Would the person with the implant be protected under the Communications Decency Act, which doesn't hold online platforms or internet service providers liable for the content that users post on their sites? or would the individual be considered to be in possession of those materials and subject to the relevant punishments? Well, this hasn't come up yet. And apparently Laufer is not concerned at all about these things, and is just happy to keep playing Johnny Mnemonic and be ignorant of all the dangers of what he might be carrying in that leg of his. Let's continue the next story, with something near and dear to everyone's heart. Cannabis? Once again, this story is going to point out that cannabis is not as benign as everyone insists it is. Also, let's see how many people stop using cannabis as opposed to stop getting vaccinations. Anyway, according to Duke University scientist Dr. Susan Murphy, fathers who use marijuana may be using it for two. The story was published in the August issue of the journal Epigenetics. Although the study was small, with about 25 men and 15 rats, it highlights a potential transgenerational effect of marijuana exposure. The passing on of sperm in which an autism-associated gene, DLGAP2, has accumulated extra epigenetic markings. I'll explain what that means in a second. Murphy identified significant hypomethylation at the DLGAP2 gene in the sperm of men who used marijuana compared to controls. Now, what does that mean? Hypomethylation, which means that there are fewer methyl groups, which is a chemical. It means usually that a gene is being turned on and activated to start making a protein, as opposed to the opposite. If you have too many of these methyl groups stuck to the DNA, it usually turns off the DNA. Well, hypomethylation tends to turn a gene on. So a similar observation was made in the sperm of rats exposed to THC compared to controls. This hypomethylated state was also detected in the frontal region of brains of rats born to fathers exposed to THC. Murphy says, quote, "Our findings do not establish a definitive link between cannabis use and autism, but the possible connection warrants further urgent study. Given efforts throughout the country to legalize marijuana for recreational and/or medicinal uses. DLGAP is a gene involved in synaptic organization of the brain and neuronal signaling, and it has been strongly implicated in autism. In earlier work, the researchers noted several gene alterations in the sperm of men who smoke marijuana. The current study honed in on the specific genes, notably DLGAP. Besides being strongly implicated in autism, the gene is also associated with schizophrenia and post-traumatic stress disorder. Other findings from the current study include a sex-based difference in the relationship between DNA methylation and gene expression in human brain tissues. In both male and female brain tissues, increased DNA methylation was associated with decreased gene activity, as I said earlier. This relationship was strongest in females and seemed to be less well-maintained in males. Well, the reason for this isn't known at this time. This anomaly was notable because the ratio of boys to girls with autism is 4-1, and there are sex differences in the neurobehavioral symptoms. Murphy notes, quote, "It's possible that the relationship between methylation and expression is modified if the methylation change that we see in sperm is inherited by the offspring. In any event, it's clear that the region of DNA methylation within the DLGAP gene that is altered in association with cannabis use is functionally important in the brain. Given marijuana's increasing prevalence of use in the U.S. and the increasing number of states that have legalized it, we need more studies to understand how this drug is affecting not only those who smoke it, but their unborn children as well." Unquote. Next story. How many years of life does a big brain cost? Dr. Alexander Kottershall of Stockholm University has decided to examine whether the energy needed to grow a big brain reduces your lifespan. He reports on this in the August volume of the journal Biological Letters. What are the two things that you need to stay alive as an animal in the wild? Well, it pretty much comes down to two factors. Make sure you have food, and avoid being snatched by a predator. Having a big brain might help because big-brained animals tend to be smarter and are able to solve life-threatening problems that might otherwise cause an early death. It is therefore logical to assume that over generations of being able to outsmart external causes of mortality, such as predation, animals with bigger brains will evolve to age more slowly. There's a problem with this, though. There's a contradictory theory that lurks behind this logical relationship. Brain tissue is the most energetically expensive tissue in the body. Growing a big brain means that animals have to divert energy and resources away from other bodily processes like growing, reproduction, tissue repair. So according to this theory, it would be logical to assume that animals with big brains or bigger brains should actually age faster since they're unable to maintain and repair their bodies over time. Cottershall studied aging in a line of artificially selected guppies. These fish were selected over four generations to either have large or small brains. This resulted in a 12% difference in the relative brain size by the fourth generation. The researchers raised the guppies from birth in a safe environment where they always had access to food and there was no threat from predation. This gentle rearing environment, therefore, removed any external causes of mortality. The guppies were even kept in individual tanks to avoid any competition or aggression among the fish, but they could still see each other so they wouldn't get lonely. Then the team monitored the guppies over their entire lifespan to reveal that the big-brained fish had a 22% shorter lifespan than the small-brained fish. Okay. Large-brained fish live for an average of 2.9 years, while small-brained fish lived for 3.5 years. The study took some time for the researchers because the longest-lived small-brained fish was over 5 years old when it died. Their findings support the idea that larger brains are costly and there is a trade-off with aging. The big-brained guppies in the study were likely reallocating their bodily resources to brain growth. There's already some support for this notion because the team had previously found that these large-brained guppies also have smaller digestive tracts and poor immune systems. Cottershall's experiment is one of the first to show how aging is affected by brain size. While big brains appear to be quite bad for longevity, the cost of about 0.6 years, at least for the guppies, that was a quarter of their lifespan, the team also highlights that their findings are restricted to a benign and protected environment. More work is now needed to understand how brain size and aging interact with external causes of mortality, like predation and starvation, which could also affect animal survival. Upwards and onwards, maybe backwards and downwards in this case. Depending on your point of view, let's talk about the human microbiome for the umpteenth time. So, findings in the journal Cell Host and Microbe last month suggest that the human mouth and gut microbiomes comprise, quote-unquote, staggering microbial genetic diversity, and it was found that at least half of all the genes identified were unique to an individual. An analysis of microbial genes in the human gut and oral microbiomes has yielded results suggesting that the collective microbiome may contain more genes than there are stars in the observable universe. Dr. Alex Kostick's research group at Harvard has generated a catalog and searchable web resource detailing tens of millions of microbial genes identified through their first sweep analysis of thousands of human samples. The Harvard study represents only the start of efforts to analyze the genes contained in the entire human microbiome. The results suggest that at least half of the genes are unique to each individual, and the apparent diversity is exceeding the researchers' expectations. The paper indicates that the human gut microbiome may contain upwards of 150,000 different microbial strains, and that even minute variations in the microbiome composition can impact human health and disease. Kostick points out, quote, "The field still does not have a grasp on the scope of the microbiome's genetic content. in the gut and otherwise. This is a question crucial for understanding microbial function in the context of disease, unquote. He also states that, quote, you may ask what the point of a study like this is, but building a catalog of the complete landscape of microbial genes could help to direct the design and development of precision treatments. Even the microbiomes between twins seem to be unique. Narrowly targeted therapies would be based on the unique microbial genetic makeup of a person rather than on bacterial type alone, unquote. So scientists can only estimate the total number of genetic elements within every bacterial species, and theoretical approximations start at perhaps conservative 1 billion genes. They state that within the human gut microbiome, up to 10 million non-redundant genes have been previously identified by major sequencing consortiums. Kostick's group says this is an underestimation by at least a couple of orders of magnitude. In total, his group assessed DNA of some 3,500 human microbiome samples, of which more than 1,400 were obtained from people's mouths and about 2,000 from people's guts. Their initial analyses identified nearly 46 million genes in total. They found staggering genetic heterogeneity in that data, identifying a total of 45,666,334 non-redundant genes. More than half of those genes were found in only one sample, and so were unique to that individual. The researchers termed these genes singletons. As to how many genes there are in the collective human microbiome, one calculation puts that figure at around 232 million, whereas another calculation resulted in a number comparable to the number of atoms in the universe. Perhaps the bottom line is that the actual number may be something that we can't even find out. Kostick says, quote, whatever it may be, we hope that our catalog, along with a searchable web application, will have many practical uses and seed many directions of research in the field of host-microbe relationships, unquote. Next story. Can gray seals act like parrots? Well, yes. Yes, they can. Have you ever wondered which animals learn to communicate with sounds and how? We can precisely control our vocal tracts and vocal cords when learning new sounds. But the capacity for vocal learning is rare in nature. Fewer than 100 attested species, with only about a dozen animals, are capable of learning how to produce sounds for communication. For example, cats, dogs, and chimps can't learn vocalizations. Doctors Amanda Stansbury and Vincent Yannick from the University of St. Andrews tested whether gray seals, of all things, can be trained to learn new sounds by imitation. The researchers trained a gray seal named Zola to copy three sounds played through a loudspeaker. To make the task easier for Zola, these sounds were recordings of her own calls, which had been shifted around in frequency to sound higher or lower. Every time Zola reproduced one of the sounds at the correct pitch, she received a fish reward. After training, Zola could copy sequences of up to 10 sounds varying in pitch, most of which she had not heard before. However, when the team analyzed the audio recordings, they discovered that instead of modifying the vibration of her vocal cords, like humans do when singing, Zola was altering the shape of her vocal tract, similar to the way we change the shape of our mouths when going from bath to boot. She could even imitate musical motifs like the Star Wars theme and Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. So Zola, the singing seal, could imitate tunes by performing vocal tract movements that we humans usually make when speaking. So let's listen to a recording of Zola. So first you'll hear the synthesized guide noise for the seal, and then that'll be followed by Zola imitating the guide noise. Okay, so we'll start with a simple do re mi.
Ah.
Now, let's hear Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And now for the grand finale. We'll probably hear this in the brand new movie coming out at Christmas, Rise of the Skywalker, the Star Wars theme. Stansbury and Yannick then trained two more seals, Janice and Gandalf, to imitate five vowel sounds similar to those found in British English. Bath, may, meet, thought, boot, to assess the animal's ability to control their vocal cords. Eventually, both seals could reliably imitate the five vowels by emphasizing either the lower or higher frequencies. The seals had changed their voices to sound deeper, as in boot, or more acute, as in meat, so that they no longer sounded like other seals. They had learned how to produce new sounds instead of recycling sounds they could already produce. So why is this lolcat-type story scientifically interesting? Well, Stansbury and Yannick provide experimental evidence that it is possible for some animals other than humans to learn to produce new sounds via modifications of their vocal tracts. This is something we humans do constantly when learning our mother tongues or a new language. Currently, many researchers study birdsong production to help us understand human speech, but here we have a much closer relative with seals and their human-like vocal tracts, and it could be a perfect alternative model species for learning about human speech and song thanks to our similar anatomy. In addition, it's possible to measure the brain activity of seals, potentially allowing us to identify which areas of the brain that the seals are using for vocal imitation. In brief, seals have much to teach us about human speech and song, and you will soon be able to download songs of the sea with choruses of seals, dolphins, and whales. Whales definitely singing bass. I mean, bass. All right, ladies and germs, the final story of the night. Is there a gay gene? Probably not, from the looks of it. Okay, so this is a question that's been around since about the time that the human genome was just beginning to be sequenced, back in the mid-90s. Is there a gene whose mutation will make you gay? We could blame the concept of the gay gene on Dr. Dean Hamer, who linked homosexuality to a specific region of the X chromosome in a 1993 study. Hamer is a geneticist, author, and filmmaker, and he's known for his research on the role of genetics in sexual orientation and human behavior, as well as contributions to biotech and HIV/AIDS prevention. Hamer is probably most famous for discovering the genetic roots of anxiety and finding a mutation in the promoter region of the gene for serotonin transport, which led to the widespread use of Prozac to help anxiety and depression in people with that particular mutation. Well, it turns out that as far as the gay gene was concerned, he was way off target. And frankly, I've thought his study of this question for the last several decades, right up until now, ranks with questions like, is there a gene that will make you a vegan? Is there a gene that will make you a Yankees fan? Is there a gene that causes you to be a Unitarian? Human genetics, and genetics in general, is way too darn complicated to simply say, good morning, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Yes, we have finished the scan of your child's genome, and I have bad news. He does have a mutation on a single gene of his X chromosome. I hesitate to say this, but I know you're from New York City and are loyal fans of the Jets, but your son is destined to be a Dallas Cowboys fan. I really do share your sorrow. You get the idea. So, what about this new study? The study was performed by Dr. Benjamin Neal's research group at Harvard Medical School, and it was entitled, Large-Scale GWAS Reveals Insights into the Genetic Architecture of Same-Sex sexual behavior. This was published in the journal Science in August. Put simply, Neil found that a genome-wide analytic scan of the entire human genome pretty much puts to rest the notion of a single gay gene. Now, mind you, they did find that same-sex sexual behavior is linked to a contribution of, quote, many small genetic effects scattered across the genome, unquote. The large genome-wide association study on 477,522 individuals found 5 genetic single nucleotide polymorphisms, called SNPs, which are associated with engaging in same-sex sexual behavior. A single nucleotide polymorphism is an alteration of a single base in a sequence of DNA. As I told my introductory bio class last week, the larger the sample that you're looking at, the more believable the results. In this case, almost 500,000 people being analyzed is pretty darn convincing. Those 477,000 genomes came from a combination of a couple of places. The UK Biobank, 408,000 or so, with individuals who were age 40 to 70, and a cohort from 23andMe of all places of about 68,000, largely from the US. Well, the primary phenotype examined was whether a person had sex, even one encounter, with somebody of the same sex. This information was taken from self-reported responses. UK Biobank participants were all asked, "Have you ever had sex with someone of the same sex?" Whereas 23andMe participants filled out an entire sexual orientation survey that included questions about sexual identity, sexual attraction, sexual experience, and sexual fantasies. From there, Neil and his team analyzed other phenotypes, including if you had same-sex behavior, what proportion of your partners have been same-sex. The paper notes that the 5 genetic variants together account for less than 1% of the variation, and all genetic variants tested accounted for only 8 to 25% of variation in same-sex behavior. Some people may not be happy with those numbers. They suggest there is a 75 to 92% probability that gayness is caused by the environment and not genetics. Oops. However, Neil is quick to note that these numbers are about populations, not individuals. And he says, quote, "It's not like an individual has a 20-80 split on the genetics and environment, and then the next person has a 30-70 split. That's simply not the way it works. Rather, these numbers are describing the variability in the population that we see in genetics and linking that variability to the variability we see in the trait," unquote. Despite that apparently small effect, this genetic variance of 8% to 25% could hint at some major biological pathways that may be involved in same-sex sexual behavior. For example, one genetic marker is in an area of the genome where genes are related to olfaction are located. And as smell and sexual attraction have been linked, that could lead to a tie to sexual behavior. But these hypotheses based on marker locations are nothing more than speculation. And how these 5 genetic variants and the rest of the genome contribute to same-sex sexual behavior will take many years to uncover. One worry about the study is that given the hazardous ways that society could potentially use results like this, is it wise to publish these standard identifiers for the 5 polymorphisms that they found? And Neil responds by asserting that it is, quote-unquote, effectively impossible to predict an individual's sexual behavior from their genome like this. He says, quote, "Genetics may be an important contributing factor, but it is less than half the story for sexual behavior. The information here is not enough to make a polygenetic risk score. In fact, we tried to perform a cross-prediction test in the study to see if we could use the factors to predict homosexuality, but we failed miserably. So if we could not succeed working backwards, no one else could or should either," unquote. Well, that's all for me for now. Don't worry. I'm sure you were born that way. The next big trend will be keeping seals in your living room like parrots. Soon, you'll be able to buy your own peg leg router on Amazon. Keep watching the skies, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.